Okay, taking this seriously, step two, no more hitting my team. My direct opponent fired another projectile at me, this time much more accurately. I stepped to the side, firing a sphere at the floor inches in front of him. Just as I suspected, the floor was charged with mana to prevent it from being damaged. The sphere bounced off of that mana and right into my opponent's chest. He had a look of utter shock as it slammed into him, staggering back a step at the impact. Before he'd recovered, I'd fired three more orbs. Taking turns? Please. There were no turns in war. Of my three newly fired spheres, only one connected with him. I deflected another two from other opponents in the meantime, sending them as close to my opponent as I could, but failing to get them quite at the right angle. I saw a projectile headed for Patrick, and it looked like it had slipped past his notice. Spinning on my heels, I fired a blast at the orb and missed entirely. My attack did manage to get very near to hitting Roland. On the positive side, Roland was on the opposite team. On the negative side, he was looking at me now, and he was looking unamused. On the considerably more negative side, he was carrying two canes, one in either hand. I wish I'd thought of that. The hail of spheres that came my way in the following moments was nothing short of terrifying. I managed to dodge or deflect six, then seven, and then eight of them before one finally slipped through. It hit me in the shoulder with enough force to send a surge of numbness down my arm. I very nearly dropped my cane. Fortunately, Roland seemed satisfied by that, turning away from me to continue his onslaught on the next opponent who was unlucky enough to draw his ire. I ducked, nursing my numb arm, trying to assess my situation. My direct opponent was gone. I was momentarily confused before I remembered that anyone else could have hit him while I wasn't looking. A further assessment told me that nearly half of the field had been eliminated. I felt a little less bad after that, but I still hadn't made up for hitting that ally of mine. I glanced toward him, considering trying to help him to repay the debt, but he was already out of the ring. It was hard to tell at a glance, but I was pretty sure our team was losing. Unsurprising, given the juggernauts on the other team. Goddess, even Sarah was over there, standing a couple lanes away from Roland. The lane to my left was empty now. I had room to move if I wanted to, but having Patrick next to me felt like an advantage. How could I use that? I stepped out of my lane without thinking to dodge an incoming sphere, only afterward realizing that I wasn't sure if I could step back into my original position without breaking the rules. Probably? I glanced back at a judge, deflecting an errant projectile that was approaching at the corner of my vision. Hey, can I walk freely between my old lane and this one now that this guy is out? Yep, you sure can, the judge nodded. I glanced at Patrick, then back to the judge. The other guy adjacent to him is gone. Does that mean he can move around, including into my old lane? The older student frowned, scratching his chin. Yeah, sure, I guess he can use your old lane if he wants to. Good enough for me. I stepped back into my original lane. Patrick, we're doubling up. He glanced to the empty lane on his right, and then back to me, his expression still focused. Got it. He stepped into the same lane I was standing in, and we shifted our stances, facing outward at diagonals. We were limiting each other's mobility, but we had complete coverage for deflecting enemy projectiles this way. I made use of that almost immediately, deflecting the first projectile that approached us and scoring an unlikely hit on someone on the opposite side. After that, I saw a couple of people staring at us, but fewer seemed to want to attack. Good. My right hand was getting sore from the mana I'd been putting into attacking, and I could tell that the other students were suffering similarly, slowing down their attacks and picking them more tactically. I swapped the cane to my left hand, taking a shot at a lone student on the far side of the opposite line. It missed, but the student dodged directly into Patrick's orb, fired only a moment later. Nice! I called. Another orb flashed into my perception nearby and bounced off the floor right in front of me. I jumped right over it, growling at someone stealing my earlier trick, and looked at where it had come from. Sarah, obviously, standing in the same lane as Roland. They had a different formation, though. He had his arms out to the left and right, a cane in either hand, while she stood directly in front of him with her cane blocking the center. She winked at me. Oh, you want to play? I was so distracted leveling my cane at Sarah that I completely missed the orb coming in from my left. It smashed into my side, knocking me into Patrick. We straightened ourselves after a moment, and I noticed that Marissa was the one who had launched the shot.
"One more point against Corin," a judge announced.
"Focus," Patrick reminded me. I grumbled, falling back into my defensive stance as more blasts flashed around us. It was less than another minute before we were practically the only members of our team left standing. The other team still had 7 people, including Marissa, Sarah, and Roland. Patrick and I had 2 other students with us, but they were far away and looked exhausted. We needed to even the odds somehow. Even in a defensive position, we were far too vulnerable to concentrated fire. In retrospect, it was shocking I hadn't tried this earlier. "The lanes go all the way to the other side." I didn't need to say anything else. Patrick had always been adept at picking up my lines of thought. Far better than my family, at least. "On 3? Patrick asked. "Rash that on 1. Go!" We bolted. A few orbs flew lazily through the air past us. I had to deflect one that actually came close to landing, but we crossed the room in a handful of seconds. We switched to back-to-back positions, facing the opposition. Marissa and 2 others on my side, Roland, Sarah, and 2 others on his. Still bad odds, but now every projectile that didn't hit us had a high chance of passing us and hitting members of their own team. Our own remaining team members used that window to open fire on the people near Marissa, taking one of them out of the fight. I joined the assault, firing at Marissa's unguarded side. Without looking, she punched the orb out of the air, sending it across the arena to fade into nothing. Okay, new tactic. Never fight her ever. Patrick staggered into me, apparently having taken a hit. All 4 opponents on his side were looking at us. They took shots, 1 at a time, conserving their mana while keeping us under pressure. Sarah yawned when I looked at her. I fired a blast at the floor in front of her, much like she had done with me. As she moved to deflect it, I shot another blast at the side of the same sphere, bouncing it right into Roland. He fell to the side, colliding with Sarah. Patrick took the opening to fire at the pair, but one of their teammates managed to fire a blast that knocked his projectile aside. Teamwork. My greatest asset. My greatest weakness. I looked at our remaining ally on the other side of the ring. I probably should have invited her to come join us, but she was far enough away that I didn't know if she'd reach us in time. As it happened, she only lasted a few more moments where she was. Marissa bounced a pair of orbs off the ceiling, which I hadn't even considered, and took our last companion completely unaware. Patrick swapped hands, and then unleashed a flurry of quick blasts at our closest opponent, Sarah. The torrent of attacks was too fast to effectively deflect, so she and Roland stepped aside, probably without realizing that they had been obscuring the existence of the orbs until it was too late for the people behind them to notice. One reacted in time, only clipped by a single sphere. The other took hits from 4 in a row, and I saw his shield visibly crack before a judge reached in and pulled him right out of the ring. I whistled in appreciation, but Patrick only shook his head.
"Think that was probably the last I've got in me. Arms feel like they're on fire."
I wasn't in great shape myself, but nowhere near that bad. Then again, I'd been dueling daily since I was old enough to hold a stick. Not many people had that advantage. I tried to bounce a spear off the ceiling to hit Marissa, but I missed her entirely. Aiming them was trickier than it seemed. I did, however, manage to dodge the attack from the student behind her. It missed Patrick and slammed into Sarah. She glowered at her teammate as she stepped out of the ring. "Okay, Sarah's out. That's just 4 against 2 now. We can do this."
"Eyes!"
Patrick shoved me, then stumbled. For an instant, I thought he'd made a classic heroic sacrifice, but the orb had missed him as well. Sorry! I spun in time to knock one of Roland's spheres back at him, but Roland simply batted it back out of the way. Patrick and I settled back into our defensive back-to-back stance.
Ideas?
He asked. If he's out of mana, and our opponents are pretty close, we could try to run them out. But Marissa's showing no signs of stopping, and I don't think we've even scratched her. Our opponents, who were furthest away, Marissa on my side, someone I didn't recognize on Patrick's, were walking forward in their lanes, toward the middle of the room. That meant they were taking themselves out of the direct lines of fire of their teammates, nullifying one of our few advantages. It did give me an idea, though. The student that was on my side could barely hold up his cane. It was charged, but I didn't expect him to take more than one more shot, if that. I glanced at Patrick, pointed at the student, and said, "Melee!" We rushed him. With no students in the lanes between us, we were free to roam. So, there was no rule preventing Patrick from using his cane to knock the other student's weapon out of the way. Nor was there any rule against me point-blank blasting the poor guy with my own. It only took one shot to take him out of the arena. Patrick took a hit in the back from Roland in the meantime, but he was still standing. He grinned at me. "Nice. Now what?" Marissa was maneuvering carefully on my side, her left hand glowing with a visible aura. On our opposite side, Roland and the other remaining student were standing still, weapons poised and ready. Charging Marissa would be suicide. Guardians are made for close combat. Rushing Roland would let her shoot at us from behind, and I don't think we'd close that distance before she could hit us. We could make a fighting retreat to Roland's side, but as soon as it's obvious we're angling for them, they'd probably attack. How can we overwhelm them from here? "Patrick, do you think you're recovered enough for another shot?" His expression was pained, but he nodded.
"I think so. If I have to."
I whispered something in his ear. He extended his cane toward Marissa and raised his thumb above the rune. If this went badly, Marissa was the least likely opponent to be seriously hurt. I grabbed onto his cane with my left hand. "Now!" We pushed the rune at the same time. I felt the mana surging through me, and for the first time, I felt that connection extend all the way through to someone else. Patrick. We were each giving it enough mana to power the blast individually. I gave it more, pushing my mana through, just like I had with my dueling cane. I felt the mana that was already charging the cane, grabbed that, and pulled it into the rune. The sphere we produced was tremendous, probably 3 feet in diameter. It whirled through the air, directly at Marissa. Marissa slammed her cane into the incoming orb, but her weapon bounced right off it. The ball impacted with her shield, leaving glowing cracks as it continued to push until she slammed a fist through the center of the orb and dispersed it into tiny fragments.
"What are you about, Corin?"
She lowered her hand, shaking it out a few times, then sent us an outraged glare.
"You trying to kill me?"
I winced. Maybe that attack had been overkill. I hadn't meant to upset her.
No, sorry,"
she replied with a pair of blasts, one for Patrick, one for me. Both landed on target. Lord Teft clapped as we walked out of the ring.
"Excellent, excellent. I haven't seen a show like that in days, maybe?"
He shook his head.
"Anyway, good ingenuity there. Roland, 12 points for asking for a second cane and lasting until the end."
That second cane was a great idea. Wish I'd thought of that. Teft turned toward another student and continued.
10 points to Jonathan for lasting to the end as well. Marissa, 10 points for you as well for your overall performance. And Corin...
Marissa stomped over to Teft.
"You're gonna reward him for whatever that was?"
Teft chuckled.
"I said the only weapons you could use were canes. I didn't say how you had to use them. Overcharging a cane would be illegal in a number of events, true, and it probably should have been a rule here, but it wasn't. So 5 points to Corin for cheating and getting away with it."
She folded her arms.
And you're not worried about what would have happened if he broke my shield?
In a worst case, you'd be feeling very numb right now. These are practice war canes, Miss Callahan. The spells they emit are safer than normal dueling canes, and even those are barely a threat. If you have concerns about the safety of my class, however, you are always welcome to leave.
No, she replied through clenched teeth. I'm not leaving.
She narrowed her eyes. I have something different in mind. After spending a few minutes nursing my numbed limbs, I left the class. I hadn't meant to get on Marissa's bad side. In fact, she was one of the few students that truly interested me. On my way out, I realized that just apologizing and explaining what I was thinking would probably help if I had the courage to do it. So I walked right back to class and did it immediately. I caught Marissa as she was tossing her cane in the box.
Hey, Marissa,
she spun, her jaw tightening as she saw me.
What is it, Corin?
I raised my hands defensively.
I came back here to apologize.
She tilted her head to the side.
What? You making a joke?
I waved my upraised arms back and forth in denial.
Not joking.
I'm not good at this. I just wanted to say I'm sorry. I wasn't trying to cheat back there, or do something that looked like it might actually hurt you. Honestly, I didn't know exactly how dangerous it was, so I really shouldn't have done that, even if it did turn out well, but...
Stop!
She frowned.
Okay. You're apologizing. And you're right. That was stupid, but... Well, you're actually apologizing? That's... Well, that's new.
I raised an eyebrow.
New?
Marissa brushed her hands across her uniform, looking down.
You're a noble, aren't you? You know I'm not, right?
I nodded. I mean, I'd guessed that, but I don't see how it's a big deal.
Do you know how frequently nobles apologize for doing something mean to someone who ain't one of them?
I hadn't really thought about it, but from your reaction, I'm going to gather the answer is not very frequently.
She laughed. It was a short laugh, one that rang of bitterness. Might be understating that a bit.
She looked up at me, letting her eyes meet mine. I didn't look away.
Why'd you do it? Why go after me like that?
I blinked. It was nothing personal, if that's what you were thinking. You were clearly too strong defensively for normal attacks to work. The other two were too far away for us to reach.
Marissa frowned. But I saw you looking at me, even before the match started.
Sure, I was looking for the toughest opponents, figuring out how to crack your defenses or work around you.
Toughest opponents?
I tapped my forehead.
See this? I have the great honor and prestige of having one of the worst attunements for dueling. The only chance I have to succeed here is through strategy, at least until I can throw together some items. And a big part of that strategy is learning how to deal with the strongest fighters we have. At the moment, that's you, Roland, and maybe that Jeremiah guy who only shows up to about a third of our classes.
She chuckled.
Not sure I agree that he should make the list. Not sure I agree that I should make the list, but I guess I'm flattered.
I nodded. Anyway, I really am sorry that I offended you, and if there's something I can do to make up for it, let me know.
Marissa raised a hand to her mouth, looking stymied. I wasn't sure why I was affecting her so much. Clearly I had miscalculated somehow, but the response wasn't entirely bad, at least.
I'll think about it. I think I should go. I should go.
Marissa half nodded, half bowed, and then disappeared into the distance. When I arrived back at my room, there was a letter waiting for me. It had a runic seal, one designed to break only when touched by the intended recipient. Opening the letter before the seal was deactivated would incinerate the document. The offender's hands weren't likely to come out unsinged either. I hadn't seen one in years. They were expensive. Now that I was an enchanter, I'd have to learn how to make them at some point. I pressed my thumb to the seal. It cracked open, allowing me to pluck the letter from within the envelope. My dear Corin, I strongly advise you to stay as far away from Karas Salirian as possible. I am aware of your personality, however, and I expect my counsel will go unheeded. Karas Salirian was last seen heading toward the Edrian border. We believe he has recently emerged from the Serpent Spire. I'm unaware of if he completed his objectives within. This is a delicate matter, and I will trust that you will be discreet with this information. If you truly are already involved in this situation, I would like to speak with you as soon as possible. Unfortunately, I have urgent business in Delanos, and I will not be able to visit you for the next several months. I entreat you to display the utmost caution until we are able to speak directly. One final time, please be careful. You will be in my thoughts. Your mother. My hand tightened as I finished reading the letter, crumpling the page. It was perhaps my own fault that the first words I'd gotten from my mother in years were chastising me for delving into danger. A part of me had hoped for more. Something meaningful. There were so many things I'd wanted to say to my mother over the years. So many questions I'd wanted to ask. Why had she left? Was I so inferior to Tristan that it wasn't worth staying? Now that I knew about Sarah's potential heritage, I wondered if that was a factor. Had Father been sleeping with another woman? Had Tristan's failure just been the last in a series of arguments? For years, I'd wanted to know the truth, but it never seemed like the right time to ask. Perhaps more importantly, I was afraid of what the answer might be. Was it my weakness that had driven my parents apart? I didn't think I could handle that. So I didn't focus on finding the truth. I told myself I had a better approach, one that would reunite my family rather than just giving me potentially painful knowledge. I had to bring my brother back. He was the only one who could help mend our wounds. I had some information about Karas to work with now, at least. I destroyed the letter. If Karas was heading toward the Edrian border, that certainly added to the hypothesis that he was working with Edria somehow. I didn't have any good means to look into that immediately. I went to try and find Professor Orden, but she wasn't around. I tried a few more times over the following days, only to learn from Professor Teft that Orden had gone into the tower. I'd have to get answers elsewhere for a while. For the moment, I had more pressing matters to attend to. I needed to make sure I was ready for the upcoming test. I would be no help to anyone if I failed out of the academy. Chapter 11. Enchantment. Professor Conway looked exhausted. He'd lost the usual effortless spring to his movements, and deep bags were visible under his eyes, even from where I was sitting in the third row of the class.
"Since our last class was interrupted by an unsightly incident," he began, not needing to explain to anyone what incident he was referring to, "I believe it would be pertinent to pick up where we left off. That said, our missed time will need to be covered to ensure we can cover the entire syllabus, and I'm confident few of you would want an extra day of class. Thus, I will be consolidating the second half of our last lecture with today's discussion. I will only have time to touch on each subject briefly."
Conway pulled a chair behind the lectern and sat down, something I'd never seen him do in any of his previous classes. He was generally one of our most physical professors, always moving, frequently drawing diagrams. It had been a full week since our last class had been interrupted. Was that still what was bothering him, or was it something else? Did he know something that we didn't? I didn't have enough information to speculate in any detail. I tried to push the questions out of my mind and put some effort into listening to the lecture.
"There are two main things that set the attunements apart from one another. The first of these factors is that each attunement gives you access to additional types of mana."
Normally, this would be when he'd stand up and start drawing on the board, but he didn't this time. He just glanced around the classroom, then continued to speak.
As you already know, everyone has grey mana, and that grey mana has different properties depending on where you draw it from in the body. There are 8 other types of mana that attunements on Velia can control. Every individual attunement gives you access to 2 of the 8.
He paused for a moment, taking a drink from a glass of water.
We have 8 attunements in Velia. Every attunement has a primary mana type and a secondary mana type that it provides. The primary mana type tends to be easier to use, but nevertheless you will find some people who focus on the secondary type. For example, as a guardian, my primary mana type is enhancement. This type of mana is typically used to bolster physical characteristics, but it can also be added to other spells in order to stabilize or improve their functions. A guardian's secondary mana type is life. Most guardians only learn to use this to rapidly recover from injuries and exertion. But there are some unusual guardians who have learned to manipulate life mana in a way similar to a mender, giving them the ability to heal others. This is more common for guardians with lung or heart marks.
I nodded along with much of the class. This was interesting material. I knew that every attunement gave users new types of mana to work with, but I hadn't realized that it was always 2 types. Actually, I was pretty sure it wasn't. Didn't elementalists have 3 types of spells? On a rare whim, I stood up to ask a question. Professor Conway turned his head toward me.
Yes, Master Cadence?
Dozens of heads turned toward me. I froze up for a moment before taking a breath and regaining my composure.
Don't elementalists have 3 types of spells? Fire, air, and lightning?
Ah, good question. You're getting a bit ahead of me. That would get into the second distinguishing characteristic of each attunement. You may sit down.
I sat. Conway continued.
The second thing that sets each attunement apart is how their 2 types of mana can be combined to create a unique result. For example, an elementalist's lightning is a combination of air mana, fire mana, and a bit of grey mana that serves to keep the mixture from detonating. Every attunement derives a unique function from the combination of 2 mana types that their attunement provides.
Another student stood up.
If I got fire and air mana from 2 different attunements, could I still combine them to make lightning?
That's a way better question than the one I asked.
Yes, Conway responded. In that case, you most likely could. Some of the so-called unique characteristics of each attunement can be achieved in that way, but there may be exceptions. Some combinations of multiple attunements are so rare that we have not been able to prove if they can be combined at all.
I scratched my chin, wondering which combinations were the rarest and how I might obtain some of them in the future. Would it be possible to get 4 attunements with completely different mana types and cover all the types of mana? I'd never heard of anyone with that many attunements, aside from the visages, of course. And possibly Karras? I still had no idea how Karras was as powerful as he seemed to be.
I've already mentioned that the Guardian's most unique characteristic is our ability to control our shroud immediately. Today we'll go over the mana types and characteristics for each attunement. This will be a brief overview of each type. More details can be found in your books.
Conway rubbed his forehead and sighed, then pushed himself out of the chair and walked over to the chalkboard. I was glad to see him up and moving again, at least, even if he did look exhausted. He drew the elementalist attunement symbol first.
As Master Cadence mentioned, the elementalist commands fire and air mana. Their unique characteristic is the ability to combine these 2 types of mana to form lightning, which is often considered the most formidable form of attack magic. While fire spells are often popular for being able to cover large areas with a single spell, lightning is generally preferred in duels. It's too fast for most attuned to defend against it.
Unless you're Marissa, I remembered with a grin. She was amazing.
Next is the Diviner.
He drew another symbol.
They primarily use mental mana and focus on information gathering spells. Their secondary mana type is enhancement, which in their case is usually used to improve concentration, retain memories, and empower spells to break through anti-divination defenses. Diviners are unique in their ability to create memory crystals, objects that can store a copy of someone's memories. These are extraordinarily useful for both investigation and communication.
Huh. Those did sound useful.
Diviners are commonly confused with similar attunements from other regions. Diviners tend to focus on learning and preserving raw information. The Analyst attunement, found among our allies in Kaelford, is focused more on enhancing the senses and digging deeper into existing knowledge. The Seer attunement from Delanos is focused on remotely viewing distant locations, something only the most experienced diviners can even attempt.
I loved hearing about the analogs to our attunements in other cultures. I knew there were similar attunements in other kingdoms, but I didn't know exactly how close they were. I resolved to pick up a book on the subject sometime in the second semester when I had a bit more free time.
Next, the Shaper.
He drew an all-too-familiar symbol representing the attunement I'd always wanted. I was starting to work through my bitterness about it. I was actually enjoying learning about enchanting, but there was a part of me that still wondered if I had failed by not earning the attunement my father wanted me to.
The Shaper's primary mana type is Earth, and their secondary type is Transference. While they are best known for being able to manipulate existing spells and reshape mana, this is not actually their unique capability. It is merely a consequence of their capable use of Transference mana. Instead, their unique ability is to spontaneously construct and manipulate objects made out of mana. While attunements from other kingdoms with earth mana can create solid objects, they lack the Shaper's flexibility to create, move, and reshape such an object instantly. Since Shapers practice this process so frequently, they are also generally the best at reshaping and altering other spells by using their Transference mana. This makes Shapers devastating in mage-against-mage combat.
The professor continued with another drawing.
Next, the Shadow. They are the only local attunement capable of using umbral mana, more commonly just called shadow mana. This is used for concealment, as well as dampening the senses of others. Their secondary mana type is enhancement, which they use in conjunction with their umbral mana to enhance their physical characteristics and senses. This unique pairing of mana types allows the shadow to create solid illusions, making the shadow more dangerous than most illusion-focused attunements.
He turned back toward the class.
It's worth being aware that a good deal of our testing at this school requires illusions. While most of these are made by shadows, we also employ a number of illusionists. Illusionists are Delanos's answer to our shadows. They are capable of creating much more sophisticated effects. For example, they are much better at concealing wide areas of terrain. Edria and Kaelford have attunements that alter the mind, rather than simply creating visible images. Edrian mesmers can alter emotions and perceptions. They often use this to lure others into trusting them. They are also capable of making others ignore their presence by tricking our minds into believing they are a harmless part of the background.
Conway took a breath.
Kaelford's equivalents are controllers. We have a few controllers on campus for specific tests. Controllers typically can only affect one person at a time, but they are capable of directly influencing someone else's behavior. For this reason, controllers are commonly employed for trials and interrogation. In your second year, you will work with controllers to learn how to resist magical compulsion.
That sounded like an interesting exercise, and an attunement I never wanted to go up against. Conway drew another symbol.
Menders are perhaps the best known of all Avalia's attuned. Their primary mana type is life, but it is their secondary mana type, earth, that helps distinguish them from other healing attuned. While there are several attunements that can heal flesh and muscle, only menders have the combination of mana types necessary to heal broken bones. The ability to treat broken bones makes menders popular all over Caldwin. In the 6 years' war, Menders wore unique uniforms that allowed them to traverse battlefields unharmed, offering succor to both sides.
I'd be shocked if no one ever used a Mender uniform to infiltrate enemy lines. Interesting. Professor Conway drew the next symbol. It might have been my imagination, but it looked like his hand was trembling.
Summoners! Among the most unusual of attunements, they utilize air and transference mana as means for transportation-focused magic. While this can be used to summon creatures, their name is somewhat misleading, as there are other attunements that are capable of moving creatures from place to place. Their ability is to form lasting bonds with monsters, which provide the summoner with unique capabilities, including the ability to conjure copies of that monster that follow their commands. These bonds extract a toll on the summoner, however. Every bond the summoner maintains takes up a portion of the summoner's mana supply, leaving that mana unavailable while the bond is retained.
I followed the explanation with little trouble. I knew most of it already, but it was interesting to hear Conway's perspective. He drew the most interesting rune, my own, last.
Enchanters are the foundation of our technological progress. Their primary mana type is transference, followed by mental mana. They are able to use this combination to transfer mana into and out of objects, something no other attunement is capable of doing directly. There are other attunements with similar functions, but none with the flexibility to manipulate any form of mana into an item. Thus, they are perhaps the single greatest reason that Velia continues to rival much larger kingdoms such as Edria and Delanos as a military power. Every citizen in our kingdom benefits from enchantments, from the environmental barrier over our city to rain-producing rods on our farmlands.
That actually sounded pretty amazing. I left that day's class feeling better about my attunement than I ever had, and more motivated than ever to get some real enchanting work done. It was time to finally put some time and effort into learning how to be an enchanter. By the end of the 9th week of classes, each of my walls, my roof, and my ceiling had a protection enchantment. The metal chain on the door had another protection enchantment. I couldn't have possibly afforded the materials for that many enchantments, but I didn't have to. I had the requisite types of mana to charge the runes myself. I still wasn't comfortable using my mental mana, but I'd gotten more used to converting the mana in my hand into a usable form. That was slow and inefficient, so I used a couple mana crystals to speed up the process. All in all, it cost me about 8 coins to finish warding the room. Not a bad deal. The type of enchantments I could do on my own were pretty limited. I was only capable of converting my mana into the types my body already naturally used. If I wanted to convert mana from my hand into mental mana, I'd focus on the mana in my hand and command it to change into the type of mana I already had in my head. It was pretty awkward at first, but I acclimated to it over time. Even for the types of mana I was able to provide on my own, I couldn't manage very powerful enchantments. I needed to infuse all the necessary mana into a rune in a single session, or the enchantment would fail. That meant I was limited to enchantments with relatively low mana requirements. The next thing I worked on was an anti-teleportation enchantment that covered my entire room. Initially, I'd assumed defending against teleportation would be difficult, but it turned out that teleportation itself was so complex that a ward just needed to throw it off slightly to make it fail. My particular defensive rune would just nudge the teleport slightly off course, specifically to outside of my room rather than inside it. None of those defenses would be sufficient against a foe on Professor Orden's level, but the next time she examined the place, I'd be a lot better prepared. I finished 4 of Jin's item requests in the same time frame. They were all pretty simple. The first was a bracelet that could make him invisible for about a minute before it needed to be recharged. Next, another bracelet that could make an illusory duplicate of him that moved about 10 feet to his right and mirrored his movements. It had great synergy with the invisibility bracelet. third, a necklace that could be activated to dampen any sounds he made. It'd work for suppressing the noise from firing his guns, too. The last was a ring he could use to generate a small illusion based on what he was thinking about. I was particularly proud of this one. It was the closest thing to actually mimicking the function of an attunement of any of the ones I'd built. It had a great deal more flexibility than the others. I made him a stronger shield sigil, too, which he hadn't requested. He accepted the gift with a surprising degree of gratitude, bowing deeply at the waist.
"You've gone beyond what I requested. Thank you."
When he straightened, his eyes shone with an infectious good cheer. He delivered more supplies to me shortly after that. I was getting more confident in my overall enchanting abilities at that point, so I decided to make a couple more items for myself. My resources were still pretty limited. Jin had helped considerably, but he was still only giving me small and medium cores, and the majority of them were a handful of specific types: mental mana, image mana, transference mana, and gray mana. The attunements he wanted me to fake for him were the Shadow, Diviner, and Guardian. Since he was giving me extras of the same materials used for those, I could build some additional items of those same types for myself. I headed toward the old university grounds to pay Lars a visit at the Climber's Court. I had some ideas I wanted to ask him about. From what I'd heard, the original campus had been dedicated to direct study of the tower, so it had been as close as physically possible. After the first time that monsters had escaped the tower and attacked the nearby students, the old university had been evacuated and the new campus had been built. Funny, considering the monsters had zero difficulty in flying over the new university's defenses and getting to us. The older buildings had been repurposed for any number of different things. Overflow housing for students that didn't fit in the dorms, a few scattered remaining research facilities, and dozens of buildings dedicated to serving the needs of climbers who entered and exited the tower regularly. The Climber's Court thrived on that close proximity to the tower. Other magic shops might have been cheaper, but Lars was convenient. The front room was littered with tables and shelves carrying dozens of items. Prices weren't listed. Lars consulted a list behind the counter before buying or selling anything. I assumed that was a tactical move so that he could vary his prices on a per-customer basis. The retired climber was up on a ladder when I came in, putting a vase on the top of a bookshelf that was laden with non-book items. I didn't know why anyone would ever want to put a vase on the top of a shelf, but he managed to get it up there without incident, waving to me as I closed the door behind me. It was early in the day, but there were already a couple other customers. A boy with glasses was thumbing through a stack of books on a table on the left side, muttering something to himself. A blonde woman was tossing a glowing dagger up and down, apparently testing the weight. But it was the masked swordsman that caught my attention. I felt a moment of panic before I processed that he wasn't Karis. His hair was shorter, and he looked closer to my own age and build. The mask was the wrong color, too. He carried an impractically huge sword, like it was weightless. With the blade rested against his shoulder, it almost brushed the ceiling of the shop. The swordsman had a blonde-haired doll in a powder-blue dress poking out of a pocket in his cloak. That was unusual enough in itself, but I could have sworn that when I looked away and looked back, the doll's expression had changed. Is there something about this tower that attracts eccentric masked swordsmen? I shook my head to dismiss the thought. I had bigger things to worry about.
Corin!
Lars closed the distance between us in a few steps, slapping me on the back.
My favorite customer!
I definitely wasn't his favorite customer.
How can I help you, lad?
He had a cheerful grin behind his voluminous red beard. Thinking about picking up some more supplies, and I was hoping you could give me some advice on what might be useful in the tower. Lars nodded knowingly.
Ah, sure, sure. Getting prepared for your practical next week.
I blinked. My what, exactly?
You don't know?
Lars let out a deep belly laugh.
Oh, goddess, boy, you're killing me. Your first practical exam is next week and you didn't know.
I drew back. I don't know what you're talking about. We're not supposed to make our first trip into the tower until the end of the year. He nodded, still chuckling.
Right, course not. But you get to go into the fake tower next week.
Oh. That made a lot of sense. I knew the Academy had a building they used to set up tests that were similar to the rooms in the Serpent Spire. My brother had taken a mock judgment in a similar facility for practice, but I'd never had the chance. When I'd heard we were going to be having tests periodically throughout the school year, I'd assumed they were the traditional written kind. But of course not. Not at a school where professors like to ambush me in my room in the middle of the night. No, nothing could be simple here. Did the others already know? Was I the only one who'd so thoroughly misinterpreted things? I'd find out, but first, I needed to get myself prepared. I was nowhere near ready for another encounter with the tower, real or otherwise. I had planned to start gradually putting together an inventory of magical items that would be useful for going through the tower in the middle of the year, but if I had to plan for next week, I'd need to prioritize whatever my first items were much more carefully. I needed to make sure I scored well enough on the test to make it through the rest of the year. If I failed out, it would be years before I could get another chance to start climbing the tower. I couldn't afford to wait that long. Right, of course. So I need to get ready for that, and I could use some ideas. Lars walked over to one of the nearby walls, gesturing for me to follow.
I've got just the thing!
He lifted an axe off of where it hung on the wall, running a hand affectionately over the surface of the grip.
This here is Maverly. She got me through some of my toughest scrapes. Did I tell you about the time with the Baron Hydra on the third floor?
He swept the blade through the air, just a few inches from me.
There I was, neck deep in goblins, when suddenly...
I smiled, but waved my hands for him to stop. I actually enjoyed Lars's stories, but I knew that one. Also, he was trying to sell me on one of the worst items in the shop, and it was out of my price range. Nothing against Maverly, but I've heard that one. Also, I've already got a magic weapon, and I'm getting rather attached to it. I patted the hilt of the sword on my hip. Lars looked at it, his eyes nearly squinting, then flashing wide open with surprise.
That isn't... Show me the blade on that, lad.
He hung Maverly back on the wall as I drew the weapon. I held it up for him to see.
Well, now there's something I never thought to see. Selys Lian, the goddess's tears.
My eyes went from him to the sword and back. You recognize this thing? He sucked a breath in through his teeth, nodding.
Put that away before you hurt yourself.
He himself was standing a cautious distance from its reach. I sheathed the sword carefully. What can you tell me about it? I briefly entertained the idea that I was holding some sort of legendary sword that could only be wielded by a chosen hero.
That sword is marked with a terrible curse.
Yeah, that sounds more like my luck. Of course it is. What sort of curse? I asked, shoulders slumped in resignation.
Once, that sword was wielded by a great warrior who loved the goddess deeply, and the goddess loved her in return, although the warrior would never know it. The warrior sought the apex of the towers, as many do, to pray to the goddess to descend from the sky so they might be together.
I listened carefully. Lars leaned up against a nearby table.
The warrior was a soul bleed, one of the attunements from the north. She was unparalleled in skill and grace, able to achieve marvels with even a humble bleed. The warrior made her way to near the top of the tower and stood against her final foe, Mizuchi, a child of the god serpent itself.
The hero's end. I felt a chill run down my spine.
The warrior's battle against Mizuchi raged for hours, but though the warrior was greatly skilled, she was of humble birth. Her sword, a simple thing of iron, could not pierce Mizuchi's scales, and though she tried to strike for a weakness, she could find none. Finally, she sought to block a blow from the guardian beast, but her blade snapped in twain. Mizuchi's fangs pierced her heart. As the warrior lay dying, she called out to the goddess, the only being she had ever loved. The goddess descended from the skies, but the warrior's eyes were already closed. I lowered my eyes. The story didn't sound true. How would anyone know the tale if the warrior had died alone atop the tower? But it still affected me. As Selyse held the warrior's body, the goddess cried for the loss of a champion, slain by the weakness of her weapon. The goddess's tears flowed to the blade, mingling with the hero's blood and forging the blade anew. I glanced down at the hilt of the sword, then back to Lars. They say that the sword has passed through many hands over time, each pursuing a worthy goal. Selyse Leanne's blade will never break again, and she cuts with the ice of Selyse's tears, but beware, she is a traitorous blade. Each time a hero wielding Selyse Leanne's has come a hair's breadth from their goal, they have failed, often betrayed by one of their trusted companions. And so Selyse will descend again from the sky, and her tears will wipe the blade clean. Until it is claimed by the next hero, destined to die by their own blade's curse.
I nearly took the sword off my belt and abandoned it that very moment.
So,
he continued, drawing that one word out in a low voice,
if ye'll be needing an anti-curse sigil, I've got a few for sale at very reasonable...
He stopped, interrupted by the single raised finger I'd held in front of him. I took a moment to fix him with a disbelieving stare. Then, did you just make that entire thing up in order to sell me an anti-curse item? Lars let out another deep laugh, slapping me on the arm.
Not all of it, lad, not all of it. It really is cursed, or so they say, but I don't put too much stock into curses. They rarely work the way people think. Never can be too safe, though.
And that's how I spent nearly half my savings on an anti-curse trinket that I suspected had no function at all. I returned home a little bit shaken from the story, but considerably better equipped. The anti-curse trinket was a feather, supposedly taken from a griffin, which I attached to the Selyse Leanne's hilt. I'd look the weapon up later to see if I could verify which parts of the story, if any, were real. Beyond that, I'd found several things I wanted at the shop, including a bag that diminished the weight of objects inside, a pair of boots that would increase the height of my jumps, a bracelet of shielding that would recharge itself over time, and a dueling cane that was enchanted to project lightning rather than gray mana. I could afford precisely zero of those things. The boots were the cheapest at only 200 silver sigils. I had 17 silver sigils left after purchasing the anti-curse trinket. I quickly found that any permanent magical item was out of my price range, but that had some advantages too. As soon as I could make permanent magical items, I could probably sell them for a handy profit. I decided I wanted to try to make a permanent item, and thus I needed materials. I had a few things I could already work with. Two lesser gray crystals from the slimes, one lesser earth crystal from the Bargensi, and the one large crystal of unknown function that Professor Orden had given me. I also had the handful of crystals that Jin had given me as payment for my help with his own enchantments. I'd used a couple on the enchantments from my room, though. My remaining resources from Jin consisted of two medium gray crystals, three lesser gray crystals, one medium mind crystal, and one medium transference crystal. I picked up a few crystals at Lars's place and asked him about their costs, bought one, and then made myself a list of his costs for future reference. Lesser, class 1, gray, 3 silver. Lesser, class 1, other, 4 silver. Medium, class 2, gray, 12 silver. Medium, class 2, other, 16 silver. Greater Class 3, Gray, 120 silver. Greater Class 3, Other, 160 silver. superior, class 4, varies by type, quoted me 600 silver for a class 4 transference crystal. The classification numbers apparently were more important than the actual physical size. More powerful crystals were denser with mana, not necessarily larger. Most people still used terms like lesser and greater for shorthand, but as an enchanter, I'd need to pay closer attention to the technical classifications as I got more experienced. There were at least 6 classes of gems, but apparently anything more powerful than class 3 was extraordinarily rare. From the prices, I sincerely doubted I'd be working with anything higher than class 2 in the immediate future. I found it deeply ironic that our attunements were named after types of gems, but these magical gems weren't. I guessed it was probably because of color confusion. A class 1 gem might be blue if it contained water mana, so calling it a mana carnelian would be confusing. The one I decided to pick up was a medium transference crystal. Almost every enchantment I'd found would require at least 2 crystals of the same type, and I was leaning toward a transference enchantment. I managed to barter him down to 9 sigils, leaving me with a single coin to my name. When that was done, I went to the divinatory and asked them to identify the large crystal Professor Orden had given me. The answer was unexpected.
"That's a class 2 universal mana core."
I blinked. "Universal? You mean gray?" The diviner shook his head.
"Nope. Universal. It's much rarer. You can channel any kind of mana into it, and it'll change into a crystal of that type. Don't waste that thing. It's rare. Only a few of the strongest monsters in the tower have universal cores. How'd you get it?"
"A gift from a teacher."
"Wow. That teacher must really like you. Those things are expensive."
"Huh. I didn't really know what to make of that." I bid the diviner goodbye and headed back to my room. Having a universal core vastly broadened my options, if I was willing to use it immediately. No wonder Professor Orden already thought she'd given me enough resources. This crystal itself was worth at least as much as one of the greater crystals in the shop, and probably vastly more due to its flexibility. I could only change it into a few types of things myself, but for something like this, I'd be willing to put in the effort to ask a friend to shift it to a different type. What could I accomplish with a single class 2 mana core of any type I wanted? Shuffling through my books, I came up with a pretty simple answer. Nothing more than I could have made before. Using class 2 cores was at least carnelian level, possibly higher. Attempting a carnelian level enchantment at my skill level had a huge possibility of failure, which would cost me the crystal, and possibly a disastrous backlash if I made a bad enough mistake. I tucked the crystal away in the relative safety of a secret compartment in the bottom of the wooden crate where I kept my laundry. While putting the crystal away in there, I found my other hidden item, the flask of water from the attunement chamber. I hadn't forgotten about it exactly, but I also hadn't done anything with it as quickly as I had planned. I turned on my attunement to look at the flask. The water inside still glowed a bright ice-blue hue under my vision. The same hue, in fact, that I saw on my own attunement if I looked in the mirror while it was active. I'd promised myself I'd do something to preserve the water in there, but I'd procrastinated on it severely. Grudgingly, I spent most of the day studying enchantments to preserve potions. Fortunately, I was able to find a few that only required gray mana. I marked the flask's exterior with ink, the easiest way to make a rune on something made of leather. Then I spent the evening putting 2 quick enchantments on the flask, one to preserve the liquid, and the second being a simple shield sigil like I was using on my walls. I didn't want a stray arrow puncturing the thing. I was getting to the point where I had a lot of enchantments to maintain. None of the enchantments I'd made thus far were the permanent, self-sustaining kind. Those were too expensive. Even the items I was making for Jin would have to be recharged, but he seemed confident he could get them refilled without people asking too many questions. I didn't ask how. I ran into Sarah while I was shopping for supplies for my permanent enchantment. She fell into step by my side, walking with me to the shop.
You sign up for a team for the practicals yet?
How does everyone know about these other than me? No, I wasn't even aware we had teams. Sarah paused in her step, staring at me for a second.
Seriously? I was wondering why you hadn't asked me to join you, and I was feeling a little left out. But you didn't even know?
I shook my head. Is this in one of our thousands of school documents somewhere? I had read those.